Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Anthropology. My name is Anna Domdai, and I'm the host of this channel. Today, we'll be talking to Ivana Bajic about her book, Can You Run Away from Sorrow? Mothers Left Behind in 1990s Belgrade. Ivana, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anna. It is a pleasure to be here and to talk to you and to our audience about my new book. Thank you.
And before we get into the book, I have a general question. You write in the beginning that you originally studied something else and then only later discovered anthropology and anthropological fieldwork. Can you tell us how that happened?
Yes, that is right. I was actually doing a research for an MPhil thesis in Greek, modern Greek literature in Athens back in 2003. While living in Athens, I was staying in a friend's apartment, and he showed me a book by British-American anthropologist called Michael Hertzfeld. And the book was related to Greece and to Crete specifically. And he said, you may be interested, since you're learning about Greece and Greek culture, you may find some more answers. And when I started reading that book, I realized that that was the language that I was looking for, all the things that I could not understand about Greece or their history somehow started to come into place when I encountered anthropology. And I realized that was the language that I was looking for. And there is also another element, and that is the fact that I was growing up and I was a student during the decade of the 1990s that was filled with political turmoil, with war that was going on in the former Yugoslav republics mainly. And all that shaped my desire to understand how the war happened, why it had happened, how we ended up in that mess that we have. So anthropology really gave me a toolbox to start exploring that experience.
Yeah, that's great. And you take a very clear stance on the importance of your research topic. So how did you come across that topic of Mothers Left Behind in 1990s Belgrade? And what role did gender and feminism play in that process?
That is a great question. And part of the answer lies again in the actual experience of growing up and living in Belgrade in the 1990s and being very much a participant observer, in a way, to put it in anthropological context, of the events that were unfolding at the time, witnessing departures of many, not only family members, but also friends and acquaintances, and hearing of other people's family members who were leaving the country. And it felt that almost everyone I knew and everyone that knew someone close to me had someone who had left the country in the 1990s. It felt very life-changing, living in a situation where people were constantly leaving that place. And later on, when I became a student, when I came to England to do a master's degree in Southeast European Studies and started learning and reading about the war and everything that happened with the collapse of Yugoslavia in the 1990s, there was a gap in literature that had said very little about intimate lives and experiences of people who were living in Serbia and in other parts of Yugoslavia as well. It's not that Serbia was exception, but there was hardly anything written at the time in early 2000s about how ordinary people lived at that time, and let alone women. There was a lot written about the political discourse, about the political elites, about nationalism and how everything created a perfect storm. But there was very little comparatively to be read about the experiences of just ordinary people. And from my experience of being a witness to that was that there was a very significant gap of the voices of older women present in literature talking about wars in former Yugoslavia. Again, not only about Serbia, but other parts of former Yugoslavia as well. And women somehow were so underrepresented in any discussions about the war. And most of that public discourse was filled with male voices. And there was comparatively very little, if not to say nothing, related to women's experiences, whereas they were usually the ones who were making those birthday cakes to celebrate birthdays of their sons and daughters who lived in Canada or in Australia or in the United States at the time. They were the ones who were talking all the time about their children. They were the ones who were trying to recreate the presence, the physical presence of sons and daughters that they haven't seen in years, sometimes 5 or 10 years, or sometimes they would see one another every few years. But there was clearly massively felt absence of their children, and they were trying to recreate that somehow. And I found that really fascinating, just walking into someone's home and being offered a slice of cake because they were celebrating their son's or daughter's birthday. And that is a memory, one of the memories that really stuck with me for many years. And I wanted to go back to that and explore that topic further with the actual actors who have experienced that kind of loss.
Yeah, as an anthropologist myself, that sounds very relatable. You just mentioned the cakes, and in your book, hunger and food are very important topics, and you suggest that hunger is a social rather than an economic problem. Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit for us?
Yes, that is a really important I would say, argument, and one that is found across different cultures. So it is not something that I only noticed in the case of Serbia and former Yugoslavia in the 1990s, but it is a phenomenon that was documented elsewhere. For example, in few of the studies about Russia in the 1990s, Melissa Caldwell, American anthropologist, also recorded that the problem of hunger was highlighted as social by her research participants, a social problem, less of an economic problem, in the sense that, and also if you have a look at the work of people like Janet Poppendyke, who studied food banks and food poverty in the United States, she also discusses the issues of food poverty as social rather than necessarily economic phenomenon. So this is something that feeds into the existing debates and discourses about food poverty in contemporary world, whereby those who have least access to social networks, and just to explain to our younger audiences, we're not talking about social networks in terms of online platforms through which people connect, but social networks in terms of the actual support of the people that one knows and that can provide financial support or any other kind of material support, such as childcare, helping with help with housing, for example, help with various sort of advice or any kind of support that one can receive from their network of friends, family. In the case of former Yugoslavia, neighbors play a very important role, as well as work colleagues. So they are more than just people that one lives with or that one works with. They become part of one's social network. And that social network then became in the 1990s crucial for people's survival, because this is where information was being exchanged. This is where people would learn about availability of particular foodstuffs in a certain part of town or in a particular shop, or where people would, for example, pool resources. In the 1990s, many workplaces stopped paying salaries to their employees, and instead they were paying either part of the salary or sometimes even entire salaries in kind, meaning that they would pay their employees in form of large quantities of particular foodstuffs, whether that was sugar, oil, flour, sometimes even meat. And one would then end up with quantities of one particular food that clearly was too much for one person or one family. So they had to share those between the people in their social network. And there was that element of solidarity between people. So if someone shared their sack of whatever they may have received, for example, flour or sugar, they wouldn't necessarily write it down who they shared it with or how much they shared with, but there would be an implicit understanding and almost expectation that that would be reciprocated at some point. So those kind of exchanges existed within social networks. And this is, I have to emphasize, it wasn't an entirely new phenomenon in across former Yugoslavia, and in this particular case, Serbia, in the 1990s. It is something that existed during socialist times, during periods of different shortages. People already had those social networks in place, but they became really vital for survival in the 1990s. Those who were outside the networks were the people who were most heavily, who most heavily felt the difficulties of the 1990s and the hunger. And those were traditionally marginalized communities, such as in the case of Serbia, Roma, elderly men. They were not traditionally marginalized community, but in this case, they became one because they were not as well networked. They didn't have so well connected, or they were not so well weaved in those social networks as women, for example. So there was a clear gender imbalance there. And another group that was really badly affected were those who depended on institutional support for either because they were very ill and they lived within institutions. There was a really poignant case of a psychiatric hospital in the south of Serbia where all the patients died within the space of several weeks because of hunger and lack of medicines and lack of heating, for example, in the first half of the 1990s. So these were the communities or the people who were most badly affected by the hunger. Those who had their social networks to rely on and to support them were more cocooned, even if they themselves had very little means, as long as they had someone to call, someone to rely on, they would be taken care of during this period of crisis.
Adding on that and coming back to the mother-child relationship, you describe how important it is for mothers left behind to send gifts to their children, mostly homemade foods and stuff like that. Yet you argue that Marcel Mauss notion of constituting relationships through gift exchange is not helpful here to understand the relationships mothers have with their children. Can you please explain how you came to that conclusion and why sending food to their children is so important for mothers and even more distant relatives who also stayed in Belgrade?
Thank you for this question. I love it because it is an example how anthropology works, really. And it's that meeting between ethnographic encounters and what we witness on the ground and try to then explain and understand that in anthropological terms. And for that, we need to go back a little bit and unpack Marcel Mauss's explanation of the gift exchange, which presupposes the existence of a relationship that happens before that gift exchange takes place. And the examples presented in this book, Can You Run Away from Sorrow, are actually going away from that notion and going closer in direction of the examples of gift exchange and gifting practices described by anthropologists working in Melanesia. For example, in the work of anthropologists like Nancy Munn or Annette Weiner or Andrew and especially Marilyn Strathern, their understanding of gifting practices is that it is not the that gifting practices exist between two parties before as a necessary requirement for that relationship, but it is to send really that gifting practices are used in order to assert one's position in that relationship, one's place in that relationship. So when, for example, a mother sends a gift of food or any other gift, but it was usually food was more important than other forms of gifts for mothers themselves, to her son or her daughter somewhere abroad, it was mainly to say, this is who I am. I'm doing what a mother in her sort of perspective is supposed to do, to demonstrate that she still was a mother. Because it is really interesting to see for these women how their identities became quite fragile in circumstances where there were no children to be mothered anymore, when those children had left the country and had little contact for quite obvious reasons. The country was under the UN embargo. There were no flights for most part of the 1990s. There was a deep economic crisis. People from the country could not really travel without having to go through many obstacles, financial sorting out visas. It was very, very challenging for most mothers to be able to leave the country and to travel to visit their children abroad in the 1990s. Things have changed in the meantime, but during that last decade, that was a major obstacle. So being able to send that parcel of food or to send even a recipe was really more a statement about one's own identity and asserting that identity to a son or daughter somewhere abroad and to say, I still exist as a mother. So it wasn't necessarily a reminder of a mother-son or mother-daughter relationship as much as it was asserting and reminding the other party in that relationship of one's own identity. And more than that, I would say it was also a reminder to oneself about that part, that segment of one's identity, that woman still existed as a mother to someone, that sort of motherhood identity, mother identity, has not disappeared with the disappearance, physical almost disappearance of a child. Because the experience of maintaining that relationship as a mother towards a child becomes really challenging when the other party is not there. How can you be a mother to someone if there is no child to accept that role of a mother? And that is why the gifts of food and even recipes became really important, and food more than anything else, I would argue, because it was so potent, because it is something that is very, there isn't a more intimate gift than food, because it is something that is ingested, it becomes part of oneself, it is built into one's body and one's cells, and it goes through the interior. So it is really penetrating someone's identity at the most intimate level. This is how food works. And I would say that this is something that mothers did completely instinctively. There was no theory going on into that, why they wanted to send food. They felt it was something that best sent a message to her son or to her daughter about who she was and how she did things. Because when you cook something, there is so much of oneself invested in that. So it is not only the choice of the ingredients or how you combine them, but it is also the very process of how those ingredients are combined. And also there is the, if you want to call it, post-production process. So how all that is packaged and how it is sent and transported. So there is a lot of thinking and planning involved. And if you think about the circumstances where the country was under the embargo, where any flow of either people or goods was heavily affected by the sanctions, it becomes almost an endeavor and a whole. It gets certain weight that goes beyond the actual dish that is being sent there. The whole price of really sending something is so much, extends beyond the actual value of that food, that perhaps what they were sending was worth in today's monies, for example, €5 or £5, whereas the actual cost of sending it would be 10 times more than that, and not to mention time and the effort that goes into all that and planning. So it really is crucial for mothers, because through that process, they're reminding themselves that that side to their identity is still very much alive, that even if a child is not there, they're still someone's mother.
I find this whole food practices topic super interesting. And I'm also interested in, like, the on the other end of the relationship, how the food is received. And you write that migrant children eventually stopped eating the gifts they were being sent, or Serbian dishes in general. And I was wondering if that was partly because of some sort of westernization they were going through, maybe, why did that happen? And then I wanted to ask, secondly, how mothers left behind thought about that topic. What did they think about their children stopping eating Serbian dishes?
Thank you for that question. I would say it is part of the question of cosmopolitics, whereby on the one hand, migrants quite often, and this is not just the case of, say, Serbian migrants in the 1990s, but many migrants across the world have a tendency to embrace cosmopolitan cuisines, either in opposition to the culture and cuisine that they're hailing from, or in addition to it. And that happens sometimes. It happens for various reasons. Sometimes it is just a pure desire to experience something new, to become someone new. Again, food and eating practices are one of the most intimate ways of building one's sense of identity and sense of belonging. And if one really wants to feel that they belong, for example, in Toronto, or they belong in Sydney, or, for example, Frankfurt or London, doesn't really matter where one is, eating whatever locals are eating becomes one of the prime ways of incorporating local culture and feeling more accepted and feeling more at home in the new place. So that would be part of the reason why migrants embrace so wholeheartedly. A lot of the migrants from who came from Serbia in the 1990s embraced with open arms new cuisines and took a little distance from their culture and cuisine that they left behind. But there is also another layer in the case which is specific to this cohort of migrants who arrived from who were coming from Serbia in the 1990s, and that is the proximity of their culture, which they left behind, to the messy war that was going on in their homeland. Let's not forget that while Belgrade is today's capital of Serbia, it used to be the capital of Yugoslavia, and it was quite an open town and quite an open city. There were many people hailing from mixed marriages. There were many people arriving during the period of socialism in Yugoslavia to Belgrade, either to study or to work, and they would fall in love, they would get married, and they would stay there. They may had been born in Slovenia or in Bosnia, Herzegovina or Croatia, Macedonia, and they would remain in Serbia. So for many people, young people who left as migrants from Belgrade and from Serbia in the 1990s, the fact that they fled a part of the world didn't necessarily mean that they were Serbian. They may have been born to mixed ethnically mixed parents, where one of their parents would belong to one ethnicity and the other one to another. Religion may have played a role as well, where one parent may have belonged to one religious group, another one to the other. And none of that probably played a significant role during the period of sort of peace, if you want to put it that way, and peaceful Yugoslav coexistence until 1991, whereas that escalated and suddenly all of these differences came into the forefront and became quite important. So for one to, for example, then say that they are continuing to eat this dish or that dish could have been quite hurtful to either their father or to their mother, if whatever they continued to eat or to consume abroad was a reminder or was sending a message to the other one that they were excluded from their choice. So all of a sudden, what one was eating in the 1990s abroad became quite a political or politicized issue, because if you eat a dish which is associated with one ethnic group or one religious group, could be a sign that one would be sending a sign back home to the other family members about how you felt about them. And food became quite fraught in the 1990s with one's identity. And since food is so delicately connected to one's identity and it builds it, for many of the 1990s migrants, it became easier in a way to bypass their home dishes and to leave them for a while and embrace cosmopolitan cuisines. That doesn't mean that practices of the people did not change. So what people used to do in the 1990s does not mean that 20 years later, they're still doing the same. Some of them could have gone back to cooking what their mothers used to cook or grandmothers used to cook or fathers in some cases. But people's habits do change over time. And as the war sort of became more distant in terms of past and the years that have passed since the end of the Yugoslav wars, so did people's attitudes probably change. What I captured really was a snapshot in the early 2000s of people's practices. These were migrants in who came from Serbia in the 1990s to London that I worked with, and those were their experiences. I also captured some of the experiences of mothers who were sending food to their daughters or sons across the world, so to different parts of the world, not only to London in the United Kingdom. And some of them had similar issues. They felt quite disappointed and really heartbroken that their daughters were commenting negatively on food sent from home. And the comments, the sort of feedback that children, adult children, were sending back to their mothers was usually contained complaints about the health propensities of the food, and that how the food from Serbia was too greasy, it was too heavy, it was too spicy. Cakes, for example, would people would often complain that they had too much sugar or too much butter or walnuts or whatever, that they were too rich in a way, and they become too heavy for their stomachs. And I find this really interesting because I came across an article that documented similar example with Japanese migrants living in South Korea, that when they were supposed to go back to Japan, that there were all kinds of issues, that they said that their stomachs could not really digest food from homeland. And there is something of this sort of attempt to really blend into the local culture. And many of the 1990s migrants did actually managed to blend in really well into their newly chosen home countries in the 1990s. But it came with a price, and for mothers who felt that they were being rejected, it wasn't just their food that was rejected, but they felt it quite personally that they were being rejected if the food that they were sending was not welcome. So again, food being so intimately connected to one's being, it becomes very difficult to almost remove it and remove oneself from one's identity, from the gifting practices of food. The food identity and one's personal identity become very much intertwined in that process. So if one didn't want to eat food from home, to mothers, that sent a message that one didn't feel like part of that home anymore.
Yeah, again, super interesting. Thank you very much for that. I think I have to move on a little bit from the food practices. How did practices of motherhood and family life change once the children left? I'm thinking about materiality here and rituals and ways of simply making a family through being together, which suddenly just wasn't possible anymore for the families.
That is studying one's changes to one's identity through the lens of the material culture is very useful, very beneficial, because you can follow by looking at how people go throughout their daily lives, how their daily routine is structured, what they use at home, what are the objects that they're using, what are the objects which are not being used, how the space is being utilized at home, what are they doing with the rooms that once were inhabited by their children. All of that becomes tells you so much more than people can say in any interview. So material culture studies are really crucial tool for understanding and having that sort of deep understanding of the processes that are going on in one's intimate experience of such transformative changes, such was the collapse of a country, the collapse of socialism and everything else. What happened often was that women in a way preserved their homes as museums of their own motherhood. They used the rooms of their children to sort of freeze the time and to remind no one else but themselves of their identity as mothers, because there was no one who was coming into the rooms of their sons or daughters. It was only themselves. And by going into those rooms and seeing, for example, the posters of the bands from the 1980s that their son or daughter loved to listen to before they left the country in the early 1990s, they would be reminded of the family that once existed there, of their own role within that family, of the mother that had quite a specific role in their society. And this is something that sort of I haven't so far focused so much on, but for the women of the generation that I worked with, and I just to specify, a lot of them were born around the time of the Second World War. So we are looking at women born in the 1930s. Some of them were born in late 1920s, but it was mainly generations born in 1930s and 1940s that I worked with. They were socialized into this identity of a woman who was expected to get education and to work, to find employment. All of them, most of them were employed during socialist Yugoslavia and had some kind of education. Some were had higher education, some had secondary education, but all of them were active citizens in socialist Yugoslavia. But despite having that role in the society, they still carried that burden of being homemakers and also being professionals in their chosen careers. And in order to assert their place in the society, women were relied a lot on family work and that invisible work that goes on behind the closed doors within their families, of being carers for their children, for their parents, for their mother and father-in-law, for example. All of that work was going on away from the public scene, away from the public eye, but within the sphere of domesticity, was the space where women during socialism really had an opportunity to exert their power, and their women's identities thrived on that power. And the situation in the 1990s, in a way, tried to reverse that. It was they were left without that tool that allowed them, without their families, that allowed them that sort of space that where normally they would be as kind of elderly women in the society, they would be expected to receive some kind of care and attention from their family members. There was a lot of reciprocity in those relationships, in the sense that elderly women were offering childcare for their grandchildren, but they were also receiving care for themselves by their daughters or their daughters-in-law when they got a bit older and they needed help and support. In the 1990s, there were very few care homes for the elderly in Serbia. Most elderly were taken care of by their family members. And in the absence of that next generation to look after the older generation, these women were left without not only without the sort of their playing field where they could exert their own power, but they were also left without the support that they would normally expect to receive in the more advanced age. So for them, it became really crucial being able to somehow reinvent themselves through that engagement with the material culture of home by reminding themselves of their position in the family, by continuing to cook for example, for in larger pots and pans, and not downsizing to smaller pots and pans, because it would be like accepting one's defeat. So they would continue to cook. They would then offer that food to other family members. They often created like pseudo family relationships with other young people, either friends or neighbors who reminded them of their daughters or of their sons, whom they then would either take under their wing or would sort of look after, or they would exchange gifts with them. So mothers use that, and women use that sort of material culture to affirm and reestablish their identity as older women, almost as matriarchs in the society. And they didn't want to give up that fight just because their children were somewhere abroad. And I found that really fascinating, how our material world is used and can by people to really heal broken identities. This is something that has been widely described among migrant communities and migrants themselves, like in the work of David Sutton and his book Remembrance of Repasts, where he writes about Greek migrants from the island of Kalymnos who are living in the United States, and how they are using food and practices with related to the food to restore the sense of wholeness of their identities. And I would say that families left behind, and particular case, mothers left behind, are doing exactly the same. They're using food and feeding practices to really mend those broken identities and to say, yes, I'm still a mother and I matter and I exist. I haven't disappeared just because my child has gone.
Mm-hmm. While thinking about this whole support topic, I have to think about support money-wise, and you also wrote like Serbia is one of the countries that receives the biggest amount of remittances like every year, and yet you write how mothers refuse to accept remittances and explain how that is linked to their supposed maybe class status. Can you elaborate a bit on that maybe?
Yes, I found that really fascinating, because when I did my first half of my research with migrants who came from Serbia to London in the 1990s, money did not play a significant role in their gifting practices. There was maybe one or two people out of 40 that I worked with who was sending money on a regular basis to their relatives in Serbia. And when I went to Serbia, equally, I worked with around 40 people over there, and maybe two or three of them reported receiving financial support in terms of money from their sons or daughters abroad. And one of those cases was someone who was living in a large apartment, and they could not afford to pay the bills for the upkeep of the apartment. And when this person said to her children that she was thinking about selling and downsizing, they asked her not to do that and offered to contribute to the monthly bills instead, because they wanted her to remain there so that one day when they would come to visit, they would have a place to stay. And the second person who was receiving financial support again said that her son thought that part of him taking care of his mother and other relatives included bringing money and distributing money to his relatives during his visits. However, she prefaced that by saying that she never touched any single cent from the money that her son had given her, and that money was deposited to an account that he would one day inherit. So in a way, that money became, as I call it, inalienable gift. It becomes a gift that cannot really be taken away. And mothers just have become in their own view vessels for preserving that money for their children to inherit one day, as opposed to necessarily consuming it for their own needs at that moment. There was, on the other hand, so I didn't experience in my fieldwork that prevalence and dominance of remittances in people's experiences, either in migrants' experiences who were supposedly sending money or in the experiences of families who were supposedly receiving money. And yet, while I was doing my fieldwork, in particular in Serbia in 2005, 2006, I was reading in the newspapers about these presumed heaps of money that migrants were showering on their family members in Serbia. The newspapers were reporting that there were around $5 billion dollars sent to Serbia every single year. We're talking about a country that had at the time around 7 million people. When you divide that amount of money by the number of people living there, it would mean that more or less everyone would have a really beautiful lifestyle, that every single citizen of Serbia was receiving every single month hundreds of euros or dollars on a regular basis. And what I was witnessing in the homes of people who actually had children abroad was absolutely no sign of any kind of lavish lifestyle. It was quite the contrary. Most people lived in apartments that were last refurbished probably in the 1980s and that had no new appliances, that were not, you couldn't see the presence of those remittances. And the more I was digging, the more sort of I discovered that money represented almost like a taboo among my research participants in Serbia, among the mothers that I was working with. They were quite offended by my question of whether they were, where was the money? Because they didn't consider that as an appropriate question to be asked, because they considered that as mothers who were, and women again, who were socialized in socialist Yugoslav, quite patriarchal norms, that it was their role and their duty to financially provide for their children and not the other way around. They didn't consider themselves as the receivers of financial support from their children, even in the 1990s when they really needed that support. Again, I have to preface this, there was one exception where that particular person accepted financial support with the bills from her two children who were living in the States. All the other mothers said those practices were something reserved for families of guest workers, of Gastarbeiter, because during the time of socialist Yugoslavia, there was the presence, again, absent presence of Gastarbeiter that dominated the public discourse. And there was almost a notion of stigma and a ridicule related to families of guest workers. These were skilled or low-skilled workers who were going to Western Germany to work on temporary migrants. A lot of them stay there for longer than their contracts initially were drafted for, and some of them even remained in Germany until their retirement. And their practices consisted of regularly sending their earnings from Western Germany to their families back in Yugoslavia. And there was a lot of negative public discourse surrounding those remittance practices, whereby that money was often perceived to be spent in unethical ways, that people were building houses that no one was then living with that the money was spent on the so-called conspicuous consumption, and that people led some lavish lifestyle. So there was, again, quite a negative image surrounding families of guest workers. And having said that, I just have to emphasize that there was a class distinction. Even though Yugoslavia was supposedly a classless society, there was a class distinction between guest workers and their families and others in the and other layers in the society, in the sense that many, if not most, of the guest workers hailed from either rural parts of Yugoslavia, and as such, they belonged to they were of peasant origin, or they worked as workers in factories, so they would be working class, and the attitude of mothers I worked with in Belgrade was that as members of the so-called self-proclaimed urban middle class, they somehow stood out, and from that sort of working class slash peasant class of peasants that guest workers represented in public discourse. And to be able to say, no, I'm not receiving money, and I would never accept money from my son or daughter who live in wherever, Australia, Canada, wherever people have migrated to in the 1990s, was a way of asserting one's class distinction and to saying, I still belong to Yugoslav middle class, even though Yugoslavia was no more, middle class was really no more, because these mothers became so impoverished in the 1990s, they really could not financially, their circumstances did not correspond to middle class anymore. But looking the way that they consider themselves on the basis of their practices and the basis of their sometimes education, sometimes their previous occupation, their cultural capital, all of these, in their views, determine them as belonging and sharing the values of that Yugoslav socialist middle class. So remittances became quite a big class issue for mothers that I worked with. And again, I have to emphasize that this was something specific for the generation of women born and around that sort of just before the Second World War, during the Second World War, who lived most of their life in socialism in Yugoslavia, that these class values that they were socialized with, they have then taken with them during that period of crumbling of everything, this socialism and Yugoslavia and the values and everything. And it just makes it even more stand out and even more extraordinary what they were doing, and saying, no, I would rather starve than accept the money or use the money that they've received in some cases from their child who was living abroad. So it is really fascinating to see this clash between the crumbling of class values that belong to socialism, and the new sort of, while the new values were being churned out in that sort of post-socialist crumbling. So I found that as anthropologists really fascinating to observe and to document.
Thanks so much for explaining that to us. I have two quick last questions for you. One regarding the book. We were talking about mothers a lot, obviously, since the book is called Mothers Left Behind. But what about the fathers left behind? What role did they play in your research? And what can you say about them?
When I went to do fieldwork in Serbia, I was expecting to work equally with mothers and fathers, and also with other family members like siblings. But the reality on the ground just changed everything, because I encountered that in most of my encounters, most of my participants turn out to be women, either because they were divorced or because they were widows. And when I started looking at where are the men, why are they missing, what happened with the fathers, there were some fathers, but significantly they were outnumbered significantly by the number of women in that research. The lifespan in 2006 for men was 69.5 years, and it was 75 years for women. So women outlived by more than 5 years their spouses, male spouses. And that was part of the reason. But another part of the reason was really that women were more open. They were the ones who really wanted to talk to me. And I ended up in a bit awkward situation that my time for research in Belgrade was coming to an end. And I had at least 10 more women who contacted me through their friends and said they wanted to speak to me. So there was almost a wish and desire, and I've run out of time. So I had to say no to them, but sadly. But that to me went to show the need of these women to just to share their stories with someone, because no one was really interested in hearing about their experiences. So I can't really say any more than that. But it was the few fathers that did participate in the research had quite different approach to their children's migration experiences. And but I could not really make any generalized statements just because there were not enough fathers present in the research to sort of be able to make any confident generalizations about them. They were missing. They were just not there. Unfortunately, a lot of them have died before their wives. So I ended up working with women rather than with women and men.
Thank you. I'm done with my questions concerning the book, but I wanted to ask in the end, what are you currently doing? Can we expect more research on similar topics in the future?
Yes, I am still very much interested in the topic of migration and how big political events have shaped families across Southeastern Europe. But this is looking closely at the migration experiences within my own family. So I'm looking at two generations before me at how people moved and why they moved across what at that time used to be Ottoman Empire and then Austrian Hungary and what is today Northern Macedonia and Serbia, and how people became almost embroiled with political events and various sort of political changes that were that involved the entire region, like the various uprisings and wars at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, how that affected families and how that changed the structure of the family. I was growing up hearing various stories and I could never really join the dots of how some of my ancestors and why they had to leave Bosnia and Herzegovina and how they ended up in today's Northern Macedonia and then Serbia. I just could not understand that. And it took me many years of documenting various journeys and trying to understand, and also how the structure of the family has changed from living in extended families called Zadruga to living in nuclear families, and the impact that migration had on emancipation of women in particular in the family. I find all of that absolutely fascinating, and migration still remains my academic sort of interest and personal interest as well.
That also sounds super interesting. I'm very much looking forward to reading more of your work. Is there anything you want to add? Have I missed something? Anything you want to tell the audience?
Yes, I would extend this as a call to colleagues and to everyone working in the field of migration to pay attention to how migration impacts families left behind, because most migration studies focus on the experiences of migrants. Hardly any studies, with some exceptions, such as, for example, studies by Rachel Pareñas of the impact of Filipino mothers' emigration on the children left behind in the Philippines. Most other studies are mainly focused on the experiences of migrants. And my conclusion from this research is that migration affects those who remain in the country of origin or in the area of origin equally, if not even more than migrants, and that that sense of displacement is often found among people who haven't moved anywhere. And in particular, in today's circumstances, where we are seeing new wars happening across the world and refugees streaming from the previous wars and from the new wars, and we can expect more refugees from climate crisis also to start spreading across the world, we cannot ignore the situation with families left behind, because what happens with the people left behind is often more tragic than what we see with migrants. Migrants are often used for political purposes. Their families left behind are not interested to politicians in the host societies, thereby, but that doesn't mean that they are not worth studying or paying attention or thinking about them when we are thinking. When I say we, I mean policymakers. I'm not one of them. But when policymakers are considering what are the best policies for migrants and tackling migration issues. So this is just a call to start looking at societies and families left behind by migrants in order to get a full picture.
Right. Perfect. Okay, Ivana, thank you so much for being on the show. It was great talking to you. I hope you also enjoyed it.
Thank you so much, Anna, for inviting me. It was an absolute pleasure, and I'm looking forward to more talks and listening to new podcasts. Thank you.